Good morning. My name is Andrew Navratchel. I am a freshman planning to major in political science, and I am also a member of the Carleton Conservative Union. We are a nonpartisan student organization dedicated to promoting the conservative ideals of limited government, individual liberty, and free markets. We publish the Carleton Observer, a newspaper of political and social commentary twice each term, and bring speakers to campus. We are bringing Reginald Jones to speak on May 11th. The event is free and open to the public. I encourage all of you to attend. Today's speaker is Rabbi Daniel Lappin. Rabbi Lappin immigrated to the United States from South Africa in 1973. Prior to his immigration, he studied theology, physics, and mathematics in London and Jerusalem, and taught theology and physics in South Africa. Rabbi Lappin, together with noted author Michael Medved, established the Pacific Jewish Center, a now legendary Orthodox synagogue in Venice, California. He continues to serve as its founding rabbi, assisting the community with its mission of demonstrating the relevance of traditional Judaism to modern life. Rabbi Lappin is also a popular radio host, well-known speaker, and noted writer. He has spoken at many national events, including Focus on the Family and the 1996 Republican National Convention. His articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, National Review, and the Washington Times. In 1991, Rabbi Lappin founded Toward Tradition, and he currently serves as its president. The purposes of Toward Tradition are to link the conservative movement to its Judeo-Christian roots, to build political alliances between Christian and Jewish conservatives, and to offer a pro-business defense of capitalism based on the intrinsic morality of free markets. The topic of his talk today is Restoring Respect for the Morality and Dignity of Business. Please join me in welcoming Rabbi Daniel Lappin to Conservative Carleton College.
Thank you very much indeed. Delighted to be here and enjoyed even the journey here because I had an intriguing seatmate next to me on the airplane, and he was true to type. I first noticed this about 20 years ago when two strangers find themselves sitting next to one another on the airplane. What is usually the very first question? You know, after the pleasantries, you know, hi, not enough seats, not enough space, you know, I hope we don't run late, and, you know. But once we actually get down to conversation, always the same first question. So what do you do? That's the polite way of saying, how do you earn your living? None of your business. What do you mean? Why don't you ask me if I'm married, ask me if I have children, ask me if what my hobbies are. Why do you want to know how I earn my living? It's none of your business, and why should it be interesting? I'm a three-dimensional personality with lots of interests. Why is that the thing you want to know about? It happens every time. And so here is how I answered it. I said that when this first dawned on me, that this was the first question, I decided to do some research in a field associated with people earning their living. Because after all, the fact is that for all creatures on this planet, the basic game of life can only be played once you've solved the initial problem. And the initial problem is, how do you extract a living from an often reluctant earth? How do you avoid having to live like a squirrel, constantly foraging and hunting and gathering, never a moment's peace, never a moment's break? How do we manage to make life on this planet, frankly, as comfortable as possible? That's the basic question. And I thought I'd look into that. And as I began to look into that, I was struck by a terrible realization. It was a realization that sent shivers down my spine, because I realized that most people out there think, now don't get alarmed by what I'm about to say, most people out there think that Jews are pretty good with money. Now, don't get nervous, because I'm circumcised, I'm Jewish, so I'm allowed to say that. If somebody who wasn't Jewish said it, well, that's obviously bigotry. But which is interesting because my research took me into perhaps the only area of academia where the removal of a small piece of skin could convert bigotry into research. And that's the area I went into. I thought, this needs some looking at. I mean, you'd have to be a recent immigrant from outer Mongolia not to have noticed. I mean, for heaven's sake, in the United States alone, Jews constitute 2.3% of the population. Ever since Forbes began doing their famous annual 400, do you think Jews constitute 2.3% of the Forbes 400 list? That would make about 8 or 9 Jews on the list. Truth is, they're never fewer than 60. So the percentage runs somewhere sort of between 10 and 25%, depending on the year. How does that happen? And it's not an anomaly, it's consistent. Is this getting you nervous? Okay, good. I hope not. It's not my intention. But sometimes one has to speak honestly and candidly in order to gain knowledge and awareness. And I figured that this would be an interesting area of research because, firstly, it was something that, frankly, it required a rabbi to do because nobody else would be able to do it. And number two, it really addressed something that interested me profoundly. And I began to try and figure out, look, there's no question about it. I mean, it's true, right? It's just true. Jews are good at business. Not every Jew. Doesn't mean there are no poor Jews. Doesn't mean there are no stupid Jews who have no... It's not... But in general, to whatever extent generalizations are true, you cannot have escaped noticing that that's a reality. What could be the reasons for it? Well, I took a look and polled and studied, and I found that there were a number of reasons that were suggested. Most of them were wrong and fairly easy to refute and debunk. For instance, one of the theories has it that the Cossacks killed all the poor Jews in Europe. Yeah, it is stupid. It's a racist explanation, really, because what it means is that Jews have a money gene that they pass down in their sperm. And so all the rich ones who could pay off the Cossacks managed to escape and come to Western Europe and come to America. I mean, that's just plain dumb. Another explanation is, because Jews are wily and cunning and smart and intelligent. Well, that might be interesting if the key to wealth was intelligence, which we know is not necessarily the case. Oh, I would grant that there is a very broad middle band of intelligence that is perfectly adequate for growing wealth. The Forrest Gump story of somebody operating at subpar intelligence becoming a tycoon, you probably would not be advised to use that as a blueprint for your career success. That is not realistic. But it's equally unrealistic to suppose that if you're up at the genius level, you're assured great wealth. If that were so, there would be no poor university professors. It's simply not the case. So the intelligence answer doesn't help. There's another answer which is quite funny. This answer says, well, you know how it works. Jews have this great big society, and they all devotedly work at advancing one another's interests. Now, folks, I don't know if any of you have seen a synagogue board of directors in operation. But if you haven't, you might just take a look at some of the extremely fierce and vituperative fights between Jewish businessmen, such as Michael Eisner of Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg, for instance, where, you know, people have disagreements in business, but Michael Eisner did not really have to call him a degenerate little dwarf. And so the notion that Jews really sort of love each other and take care of one another and give each other hands up, I wish it were true, frankly, but it isn't. The fourth and final explanation that needs to be refuted is, well, you can get a clue from the fact that the Oxford English Dictionary used to, and I don't know about the post-World War II editions, but all the pre-World War II editions, I'm sure you have one in your library, I have one in mine, they defined the word Jew also as a verb, as in to Jew somebody. And this was not uncommon. You'll find it, for instance, in not in the movie, obviously, but in the novel, Gone with the Wind. The phrase is used more than once, if I remember correctly, as in he Jewed him down. And so to use the word Jew as a word for ripping people off and cheating them, could that be the explanation for Jewish business success? Maybe we're just really good at ripping people off. Well, you laugh, but it might be an explanation. And I methodically and in an academically rigorous fashion, I worked at refuting that, and it was not very hard to do. It was really easy to find across America, by the way, across America, and I documented many of these interviews, countless people who have no Jewish ancestry, who have lengthy, lengthy business relationships with Jews. Now, here's one thing. Does dishonesty give you an advantage in business? You know, people say honesty is the best policy. Does dishonesty give you an advantage? Of course. Welcome to reality. What did you think? However, only for a very short period of time. Only until people have taken your measure. And at that point, nobody wants to do anything with you. You have a bad reputation. And so the notion that Jews prospered by ripping people off, I couldn't accept. Just because while there are obviously some rotten Jews out there, that's not the overall secret to the broad-based pattern of Jewish business success, because if it were, the word would be out there, never do business with a Jew, and that's just simply not the reality. There are long-term friendships and long-term business relationships between people who are not and people who are Jewish, so that did away with it. So what was the explanation? And I was indebted for the key, the solution, in addition to a certain amount of rabbinical research that occupied the best part of 20 years of my life. It really became clear to me during a televised debate with a man called Al Goldstein. Can I ask how many of you have ever heard that name before today? Okay, Al Goldstein, yeah, he probably belongs to another generation. Al Goldstein was even before the hippie generation of the 60s, although he was involved in that, but he preceded that. Al Goldstein produced a magazine called Screw Magazine. Now, for those of you who may have led admirably sheltered lives, I should tell you that Screw Magazine is not the official journal of the hardware industry. We were going to debate pornography, essentially, and I prepared, because, you know, Al Goldstein, much more experienced person, he was older than I was, he'd been around the block a few times, and I was pretty nervous about this debate, frankly, and I worked and worked and worked, I really prepared for it, and I developed my entire thesis of pornography being degrading to women and how it is that it creates an impediment to durable marriages in the sense that no woman who has been married to me for a few years and added to my joy in life by presenting me with little miniature Lappens who think I'm the greatest person in the whole world, poor fools, and now I'm going to expect in my mind, how can I possibly compare this woman who's been with me for maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years with the rather striking-looking young lady in the video or in the pages of the magazine? And so even on a subconscious level, I'm setting up comparisons on my subconscious level that on some deep level make me just a little bit dissatisfied, a little less happy in my marital situation. You know, this was the just not sort of prepared this whole thing, and it's not the subject for today, so I won't go into in depth, but I thought I'd be able to hold my own on that. To my astonishment, is because that's what I thought. I thought Al Goldstein would come on and say, hey, pornography is fun. That's all there is to it. It doesn't hurt anybody. Just grow up and relax. It's just nice. If you don't like it, don't do it, but it's nice for the rest. That's what I thought he'd say. But he didn't. He came on and he said, my mission in life, I have dedicated my entire existence to rescuing America from its repressive past. I help Americans get in touch with themselves. Didn't strike me till later that he meant literally. And this was extraordinary. This really threw me for a loop. Because he was painting himself as one of the founding fathers. I didn't know what I was going to say. So I decided to fight dirty. And I, as soon as it was my turn to respond, I said, "Al, this is really quite fascinating. It just shows how wrong a guy can be. I always assumed that you were nothing but a dirty old man distributing the degrading to the depraved. And now I realize that you belong on the Mall in Washington, D.C. There should be a statue to you. You are part of the pantheon of American culture. You're part of our founding. Future generations owe you a debt of gratitude." At that point, he recommended that I do something, which, as I realized afterwards, was anatomically impossible, and they had to bleep it out. And when the bleep ended and we were sort of able to come back, he was not a happy camper at all. And I said, "Well, look, let me tell you, you really did teach me something today. You taught me that even pornographers need to feel that how they earn their living is meaningful and significant. That's what you taught me." And that tied in beautifully to my understanding of what it was about the fact that Jews succeeded so well. You see, the reality is that in life, it is truly difficult to succeed at anything that deep down you consider to be morally reprehensible. How you view yourself and how you think of your role in the world will really impact how well you do. That's one of the reasons that there is a home team advantage, not just in sports, but also in the military, where you feel that your nation is being invaded and you are acting in a defensive role. There is added power. The military historian John Keegan says it's a 5-to-1 advantage. You should recognize that the added commitment and zeal on the part of the team, the home team, is tremendously powerful. You know, 50 years ago from this Thursday, May the 6th, 1954, Roger Bannister ran the first 4-minute mile in human history. Never been done before. Not even close. How many people do you suppose ran a mile in 4 minutes in the first 12 months after Roger Bannister did it? Dozens is the correct answer. Dozens. Hello? Why didn't some of them do it a few months earlier? Then they could have gone down in the history books. Answer? They didn't know that it could be done. We human beings develop incredible energy, incredible creativity, incredible drive that fuels our efforts and propels us to success from the way our minds operate, from what we're thinking about ourselves. And that's part of the whole motivation industry, and that's what a coach does in athletics, and that's what we do to ourselves when we psych ourselves up before something. All legitimate, all true, all works. Because we are human beings. That's what one of the things that distinguishes us. We are spiritually driven and driven by what's going on in our minds and what we think of ourselves and what we're doing with ourselves. So if we believe that business is reprehensible and horrible and the act of making money is inherently flawed morally and that wealth is a de facto evidence of wrongdoing, then obviously we're not going to do very well. But it turns out that in Jewish culture, and this has nothing to do with genes, and it has nothing to do with intelligence, and it has nothing to do with stealing and cheating, but if we just look at the culture itself says there's something really valuable and good in making money. There's something morally good about the process called business. What's that? How can that be? It's totally different from what we're all trained and taught and indoctrinated to believe. I mean, after all, we all know terms like filthy rich and stinking rich. Anybody know expressions that sound like noble rich, good rich? Long time ago, many years ago, that was true. What do we speak of? What do we call the 19th century industrial titans who built America and to a large extent opened up the country, brought freedom from drudgery to people who are now able to ride the trains and burn kerosene and use electricity instead of whale oil? What do we call these people? We call them the robber barons. When did that term come into existence for the very first time? Well into the 20th century. Well into the 20th century, a political journalist who was he was Jewish as well, his name was Josephson, coined the term for the first time. It was never used. How did people feel about these industrial titans in their day? People used to say to their children, grow up one day and you'll be like Andrew Carnegie. And people would recognize that libraries in hundreds of towns across America were built by Andrew Carnegie. And people didn't say, oh, he's trying to buy respectability from all these terrible things. People spoke of these titans in terms of admiration. Nobody said they were perfect. Nobody said they were saints. But neither was their wealth evidence of their deep moral imperfection. Even in entertainment, it's quite interesting. The Pierce Brosnan, James Bond film, The World Is Not Enough, they took actor Jonathan Pryce and made him up to resemble a Rupert Murdoch of News Corp. Identical, splitting image. And the movie was all about this evil, horrible, dreadful media tycoon who was taking over the world and killing people and despoiling the environment. And that was essentially the message of that film. And if you think about movies like Wall Street and Boiler Room, and if you think of sitcoms like, or not coms, but television dramas like Dallas and Falcon Crest and all of these, you will know that the majority of murders in America are committed by successful businessmen. You will know that the scenario, remember the A-Team? I can't tell you how many episodes, I've studied this, I can't tell you how many episodes of the A-Team. Any of you remember the old A-Team series? How many episodes were absolutely standardized? Evil, wicked business tycoon, top floor. When the camera pans up the silvery, shining skyscraper to linger on the top floor, you just know what's coming. We're now going to go into the office of this evil person who is destroying the environment, and the hero who has discovered it is now confronting him. And at a critical moment, the evil, vicious businessman reaches into his top desk drawer to pull out what? His day timer? No, his .357 Magnum revolver to blow away the hero. And at that point, the A-Team blasts through the door and everything is okay. I mean, that's the standard pattern. This is the depiction, and I spoke to a number of TV and movie producers who admitted. And I said to them, what evidence do you have that business leaders are these vicious, violent criminals who are destroying everything in their greed and murdering people? Where do you have that? He laughed. He said, no, it's just entertainment. I said, but do you think that's what people are really? He says, no, of course not. We're not idiots. So I said, why do you do it? He said, it's very simple. What people today can we depict as the violent murderers without getting into trouble with some group or another? And so we pick businessmen as the group. It's simple because nobody defends them. There is no anti-defamation league of business. Doesn't exist, you see. And so here we have the pattern. And people are taught and indoctrinated through entertainment. And it gets to the point where it merely confirms what everybody expects. Now, to be sure, particularly with what we've seen in the news over the last 3 years. Obviously, there are bad apples out there, no question about it. But it's interesting to just look at the numbers. If you think about it, how many business professionals operate in America bringing the goods and services to people all over the world that they desire? How many? Hundreds, thousands, or millions? Right? It's millions. After one of the most aggressive investigations and prosecutions in history, how many have we found? How many rotten apples have we found? 10, 20, 30, not even 50, not even 100. Out of millions. We must remember the balance here. Of course they're rotten apples, and there are all kinds of reasons for that, but the basic one is human nature. But at the same time, there are also a lot of good people out there who are earning honest livings, doing things that other people really want. Now, we need to look at the next point, but before that, I want to give you an example of how it sometimes happens that we can use technical nomenclature, and then we find that we're obscuring the truth behind a veil of esoterica. For instance, and this is obviously something I know something about, which is anti-Semitism. The term anti-Semitism is used extensively and frequently. People are called anti-Semite with relative ease. I'll give you an example. Most recently, many Jewish groups labeled Mel Gibson as an anti-Semite, and it was taken absolutely for granted. And that was when it began to dawn on me that it's not responsible to label people with a term that you have not identified or defined. And so I began writing articles asking for a definition of anti-Semitism from anybody who uses it. Because you see, the entire moral legitimacy of any system of jurisprudence is that the accused has to be found guilty of doing something, or alternatively, by corollary, the accused has to have a way of proving his innocence. And I realized anti-Semitism has to do with what's in your mind. Now, how does somebody prove to a court of law what is not in his mind? I don't even always know what's in my own mind. How on earth do I know what's in yours? Is painting swastikas on a synagogue anti-Semitism and very bad, but painting graffiti on a church is fine? Is that okay? What's that all about? It's a real problem. The action is defined by what's in the mind of the performer. That is a very dangerous road to walk. That is the road that takes us down towards thought police, mind control, and censorship. You're telling me what I may or may not think. What is anti-Semitism? That you don't like any Jews? You don't like Jews more than absolutely necessary? You don't like some Jews? Well, then call me an anti-Semite. There are plenty of Jews I dislike. What is it? What does the phrase mean? How can you call somebody an anti-Semite who in his whole life has never harmed or injured a Jew? What does that mean? I didn't get it. I still don't get it. It's a real problem, and it helped me understand that in the real world, actions trump intentions. In the real world, a system of justice works far better when we spend more attention focused on what was done than we spend focused on what was in the mind of the doer. It is simply dangerous to have a situation where two people can do exactly the same action. One gets an award and the other gets thrown in jail. Same action, because the court or the government or the state declared, we don't like what was in your mind, we don't mind what was in your mind. It's not good. And so, you know, I think to myself, would I rather have as a next door neighbor somebody who in his heart doesn't really much care for me? In fact, he dislikes me. But he's been a model neighbor. When the one of my water pipes burst and I wasn't home, he called me up to say, "You better come home and check. Your water line has burst." He's considerate. I know he dislikes me. In his heart, he really loathes me. But he behaves as a model neighbor. Or on the other hand, how about somebody who is just filled with protestations of how much he loves me and how much he likes me, but he keys my car, kills my cat, and beats my kids? You know, what would you rather have? And so I realized that we often make a mistake in, first of all, using terms like anti-Semitism without getting down to the basics of what they mean. And so as we start looking at business, I could obviously sound like an economics major, and I can talk to you in terms of equations and principles and econometric models, and I can give you all kinds of supply and demand curves. I'm not going to do that, because that is sometimes makes it too easy to obscure truths hiding behind that veil of esotericism. I don't want to do that. I'd rather just look at the basic realities. And the basic realities are, what would you rather have? If somebody is about to give out some money, all right, here it is, line up, we're giving out money. In this line, you're going to get $10, and you're going to get it as a gift from somebody who, you know, can't really afford it. I mean, he's reaching into his pocket, and he's going to give you $10. But if you stand in this line, you're going to get $1,000 from somebody who not only is a millionaire, but by every act of giving you $1,000, he makes $5,000. Which line do you want to go to? Do you want to go to the spiritually pure and morally pristine line there, where you'll only get 10, but it's from somebody who is really reaching into his... Be honest. Does anybody hate humanity so much that you don't want this man to make $5,000 by you taking $1,000? It doesn't make any sense. And yet, that's partially what we're saying. What we're saying is that somebody who runs a business and makes it possible for people to earn a living with a degree of dignity and a degree of ease unknown until recent times and unknown in many parts of the world, but because that person is profiting, there is something inherently flawed in what he's doing. And that is the parallel. I can stand in line and get charity, or I can stand in another line and work with somebody. Maybe I do a transaction with him and I benefit a little bit, and he benefits a whole lot. Is he exploiting me? Some people think yes. I think not. And I thought that to make this a little bit clearer, it helps an awful lot to take a look at some of the realities of how money works. Take, for example, a thought experiment, and ride along with me, if you would, as we imagine some kind of cataclysmic disaster that wipes out everybody in the whole world except you. How rich are you? I'd say you're probably the richest human being who's ever lived in all of history. You own every piece of real estate. You own all the money in all the vaults. You own all the jewelry. You own the gold in Fort Knox and the gold under the Federal Reserve in New York City. You own every single Lexus and BMW that's ever been made and is still on the roads. They're all yours. There isn't anyone else in the world. Just bear with me for a moment. I know what some of you are thinking. I mean, some of you are thinking, well, it's not all bad. I'll be able to get parking in downtown Minneapolis. But beyond that, the question is, how rich are you really? There's only one way to know. The way to know is to see how you're living. Let's see. Well, you come home in the evening and you say, this is going to be great. Finally, I'm going to have the television remote to myself. I'm now going to be able to sit back with a couple of brews and I'm going to just watch TV. What happens when you turn on the television? Oddly enough, no programming. nobody to operate it. Actually, when you decide to instead just read a book and you turn on the light because the sun is going down, guess what? No electricity, nobody running the power utilities. Well, no problem, you get out the candles. And when you run out of candles, well, just go down to the local department store or the grocery store. They all belong to you. How are you eating? Well, that nice restaurant that you occasionally frequent, can't go there because there's nobody to make the food or serve you, but you can certainly go to the grocery store and get whatever you want until everything has gone bad or you've used up whatever there is. What happens when you want to drive around? No problem. Pick up the nearest Lexus, go driving. What happens when it runs out of gas? Pull over to the gas station. Sorry, gas pump not working. The fuel tanks are underground, needs electricity to pump it up. Well, no problem, just switch to another car. What happens when you've used up all the gasoline sitting in cars abandoned on the streets? Well, now you have to catch yourself a horse or a donkey. And how about when you've used up the food in the supermarkets? Well, you'd better plant something and hope that a crop comes in before you starve to death. Notice that after a short period of time, as the only person on the planet, you are living the life of the most primitive, poverty-stricken subsistence farmer in the most forgotten and abandoned corner of the planet. You moved from the richest person in history to a subsistence farmer. What's happened? Nobody out there to do things for you. But who does things for me? People do things for themselves. They're not doing things for me. Remember, we spoke about motivation, intent. Let's not worry about the fact that when I get up in the morning and go outside, there's a bottle of milk that the milkman dropped on or placed on the doorstep. Why did he do that? Because he loves me? Let's forget the motivation. He did it for me. He did it so he can get paid, obviously. Fine. So would you rather have somebody selfish in his heart who behaves beautifully to you, or would you rather have somebody who loves you but stays at home and doesn't deliver the milk? I'd rather have somebody who delivers the milk. And so it is, as I operate within the world, I recognize that everybody's busy doing things for me, obviously for their own motivations and for their own reasons, but as soon as they stop doing it, then that's when I really notice it. And so how does wealth really get created? Well, let me take you to my great-grandfather's day, and I'll show you how he created wealth. We'll just look at a miniature model, but to get the aggregate picture, you just multiply it. The picture is the same. My great-grandfather was a peddler. He used to go from town to town. And so let's watch him as he arrives in a small village and knocks on the first door. Bangs on the door. They open the door, and he says, "Hi, remember me? I'm Joe Lappin. I'm here." They say, he says, "You got anything? Anything you don't need?" "No, I don't think so." "Think hard. Is there anything you were going to call to have taken away or you were going to throw out?" "Oh, yeah, wait a sec. Weren't you in the check?" "Yeah. There's a broken table in the basement." And they said, "Well, were you going to have it taken away?" They said, "Yeah. How much does it cost to call up a haulage company to come and cart away your table?" "About $10. "Okay, I'll tell you what. How about if I give you $5 for your table?" They think, "Oh, that's nice. Sure, take it away." Now my grandfather's walking around with a table that he's paid $5 for, and which the family saved themselves $10 that they didn't have to pay to have it carted away, and they've got $5 in cash. My grandfather spends a dollar on some nails and some paint, and he fixes up the table, and he knocks on the next house. "Hello? Do you need a table?" "No, don't think so." "Oh, wait a second. Our daughter's getting married, and there's a young couple starting out. Yeah, we could use a second-hand table." "Well, what were you planning on doing?" "We were going to go down to the store and get a table." "How much does the table cost?" "$20. He said, "I'll sell it to you for $10. "Would you like that?" "Sure." They take the table and off they go. My grandfather continues, a great-grandfather goes on his way. Let's just do a quick calculation here. It's quite straightforward. How much better off is the first family? Well, they didn't spend $10, so they're $10 better off, and they got $5 in cash, so they're a total of $15 better off. That's very nice. Second family was going to spend $20, but they only had to spend $10. So they're $10 better off. So the first family is $15 better off. The second family is $10 better off. And by the way, this isn't smoke and mirrors. This is basic arithmetic. And how about my grandfather? We're not finished yet. My grandfather's got some money in his pocket as well. How much? $4. He got, right, he got 10 for the table. He paid 5 for it, but he also spent a dollar on nails and paint. So he's got $4. So by my grandfather knocking on two doors, how much is the aggregate wealth improvement for the village? Well, 15 for the first family, 10 for the second is 25, and my great-grandfather, 4, $29. By the simple act of facilitating transactions, $29 has been added to the wealth of the village. Now imagine my great-grandfather doing it again and again and again and again. Is it any wonder that in the old days, villagers used to welcome the peddlers who would come through town? Not just for what they brought in the goods and commodities, but also for the transactions. It so happens that the wealth creation in the United States has peaked in every period in which there has been a breakthrough in human connectivity and communication. The canals, the railroads, steamships, the telegraph in the mid-19th century. Massive peaking in wealth creation in America. Why? Because all of a sudden, merchants in Pittsburgh could find out the price of wheat in Chicago and arrange the transaction. Here's the secret. Every time two human beings perform an exchange with one another, wealth is created. That's what happens. That's the reality. Now you know the great secret of the most profitable website on the internet. It's called eBay. You know what eBay is? eBay is nothing but 10 million of my great-grandfathers. That's all it is. It's this electronic peddler which buys junk from one person and makes him happier, sells it to somebody else to whom it isn't junk and makes him happier. And guess what? There's even something in the middle left over for eBay. It's no surprise. Wealth is created when people do things for one another. And so I would ask you, now again, I would ask you, mostly if you're working, if you're a full-time student without a job, this question is not that relevant. But put yourself, if you would, in the mindset of somebody who is working, and I said to you, take out a dollar bill. And look at that dollar bill and tell me how you obtained it. The truth is that if you didn't rob a little old lady on the way here and steal it from her, and if you didn't defraud anybody, the truth is you got that dollar by pleasing somebody else. It might have been a customer, a client, a boss. Whoever it was, somebody gave that to you because you did something for them or gave them something that they valued more than they valued the dollar. That's called wealth creation. That's what happens. And so obviously, the last person on earth can't create wealth because there are no other human beings with whom to effect exchanges and transactions. Every transaction actually brings about an increase in the wealth of the society. The transactions are what does it. And so, not surprisingly, when Stalin killed off an entire generation of business people, what happened was the food rotted on the ground. The starvation in the old Soviet Union was not a function of meteorological conditions. You only had to go a few miles out of the cities to find food rotting in the fields. What was missing was somebody to take the risk of buying it from the farmer and bringing it into the marketplace in the city and selling it to the residents. That person, from way back from Marxist principles, was deemed an exploiter, and that category of person was annihilated. The result is people starved. It depresses me no end that in the United States we have a tax code that classifies something as unearned income. What that means is that if I put my money at risk in the hope of a profit down the road, so as that money is then available to somebody else to buy a home with, or somebody else to buy a car with, or somebody else to get a student loan with, the interest, any success I get is termed unearned income. You didn't really earn that, Lappin. You, next step after unearned is not justified, no right to. I think that's pretty dangerous. I'll give you another example. I really do not believe the term was used when William Carlton gave a large sum of money to this college. I don't believe the term was used because it wasn't used back then, but we use it now. And I hear it all the time, and it makes me smile sadly. You know what the term is? When wealthy entrepreneurs make an endowment to a college or give a gift to an art museum or help support the orchestra, the phrase they use again and again and again, you'll find it in the newspapers, you'll find it in the adulatory speeches, everyone says, isn't it wonderful? He's giving back to society. Just think about this for a moment. If making a charitable donation is giving back to society, what was the process of creating that wealth in the first place? Obviously stealing and taking from society. If this is giving back, then I must have taken in the first place. But the model I try to demonstrate by means of my two lines of charity indicate a basic truth. And that is that as tough as it is for me to relate to this idea, I still grapple with it. But on some level, it is not illegitimate to say that Microsoft does more good for more people than Mother Teresa did. Now, Mother Teresa operated in a slum, and she gave selflessly and required little for herself. And Microsoft is obviously doing very well indeed. But they're also doing a lot of good. There are a lot of people who work for them. There are a lot of people whose retirement money is invested in them. There are a lot of people whose own capacity to earn money is improved by your version of Windows or Office, with all its problems and all its shortcomings. The fact is, I am better off with it than I was 20 years ago. I am more productive now than I was back then. Maybe Bill Gates should be sainted. Maybe he's doing more good for the world than Mother Teresa did. It's a different way of looking at things, but I'm not sure that there's no legitimacy there. Because business does tend to bring out good things in people as well as bad. Does it produce greedy people? Sure. Does it produce crooks? Of course. Are you telling me that the teaching profession doesn't? You've never ever heard of a teacher sexually exploiting a student? How about doctors? We always think of doctors as a very moral preoccupation, right? And you sometimes imagine, I've never actually seen this, but I think of the scenario, imagine a high school where the teacher asks different people to stand up and say what they intend doing professionally, like my seatmate on the airplane, you know, what are you going to be doing? One person gets up and says, well, you know, I want to be a biology researcher and I want to find a cure for AIDS. You know, everybody applauds, that's terrific. And somebody else gets up and says, you know, I want to be a child psychologist to help children. That's terrific. Somebody else gets up and says, you know, I want to find a cure to cancer. That's wonderful, everybody's terrific. One person gets up and says, I want to build an enormous business that provides a dignified living and makes a lot of people wealthy. Where's your altruism? Where's your idealism? And this is one of the ways in which truths get obscured by nomenclature and by terminology. It's a shame and it's unnecessary. And so we look at some of the things that business tends to produce. I'll tell you one of the things business produces. I don't believe it produces more rotten people than other professions. But it also tends to produce, for instance, trust. I'll show it to you. An example of the way business encourages trust is brands. Now, people always say, oh, you know, American brands are just taking over the world. Well, wait a second. Have you ever heard of Nestle? Have you heard of Nokia? Have you heard of Volvo? Have you heard of Sony? Right? The brands that are dominating in the world are brands that are copying the American model. And what is the American model? The American model is based on essentially trust. I will go and pay more for a Sony piece of equipment than an unbranded piece of electronic equipment whose name I've never seen before. Who says the Sony one's going to be better? I don't know for sure. There's no guarantee that it's better. All I'm going on is that the Sony people have invested a lot in building up a reputation. It's not worth their while squandering it on a piece of shoddy merchandise. That's what we're talking about. That's exactly what trust means. And this has value. It's so valuable that brands can even come back long after they're gone. Think of the Volkswagen bug. Gone? Forgotten? No, when it came back, people remembered. It had value. Do you remember the Mini? They even redid the Italian job because the Mini car came back. It had brand value. People trusted it. It stood for something, and it meant something real and significant. I think that business also encourages the things we respect in, say, teachers and doctors, which is mentoring and caring. You know, I don't know that there's a single successful business professional in America, man or woman, who has not mentored young people. It's part of the business game. You teach young people. That's one of the reasons that constantly the most successful companies are incubators for people who leave the company and move on and start their own companies after they've been taught by the entrepreneur, they've been taught by the business professional. This happens all the time. So in exactly the same way as teachers mentor, so do successful business professionals. And if you ever find yourself working for a business professional who doesn't mentor and doesn't want to see you grow and expand and become better and more competent, leave and go somewhere else. You've got a bad one there. Doctors, we think of the doctor who sits up through the night with an ill patient. But you know, there isn't a business professional who's successful who doesn't know that employees get paid before you get paid. There's not an entrepreneur who has not had his sleepless nights just before payday trying to worry about how he's going to make payroll. And there's not an entrepreneur around who hasn't had the experience of having to tell his family, there wasn't enough money to pay me, I'm the owner of the business, but the employees got paid again this week. That's how people function. It's drawn from you by business. And finally, the last thing that business tends to encourage is communication and courtesy, collaboration. And I often think of how extraordinary it is when a person walks into a shoe store to buy one of those fancy sneakers with a red light in the heel that flashes when you walk, makes you look very cool. And what happens when you walk in? A total stranger you've never seen before goes down on his knees in front of you to take off your shoe and put another one on. And at the end of the transaction, you're as happy as could be. You finally found the sneakers with the red flashing light. He's happy because he's now sold some more inventory and he'll be able to be profitable and keep his store open. And there's a transaction. And people are courteous to each other. It's not an accident that America is the engine of prosperity in the world, but it is also recognized as the most courteous and friendly nation on earth. Now, Europeans often mock us, and I have this all the time. You know what's really dumb about America? You walk into a store in America and people say, "Have a nice day." They don't even know me. They don't even care. Do they really care if I have a nice day? That's not the point. The point is they say it. There's value in that. It's just nicer living a life among nice people. I mean, have any of you had the experience of living among grouchy, grumpy people? It's not fun. It's not an accident that the friendliness and courtesy of America is also the source and related to the wealth creation of America. It's not an accident that early on when we sought a symbol to use for the dollar, our early founders were completely comfortable relating the dollar sign to the name of our country, U.S. And so the original dollar sign was just the initials of our country, United States. The U lying on the S, and the bottom curve of the U began to be congruent with the lower curve of the S, and you end up with an S that seems to have two vertical lines through it, but it's really a U lying on an S. And they were quite comfortable with that, because the essence of our country, and when Calvin Coolidge, President Coolidge, said the business of America is business, he didn't mean that in a cynical and degrading kind of a way. Not at all. He meant it in a way that business is positive. It encourages people to be friendly towards one another. It encourages people to communicate with one another. Yes, because there's profit in it for me, I grant you. So what? And it encourages collaboration. And it encourages cooperation, and it encourages creativity. And you know what it also encourages? Peace. It's been shown again and again and again. It's almost self-evident. You don't even need to go to the library to prove it. People who are doing business with one another don't end up fighting one another. It's one of the surest ways of bringing peace among people is find a way for them to both benefit. And that's the beauty of a totally transparent, honest, open business deal. A totally transparent, open, honest business deal is I'm not hiding anything from you. I don't have to, because we can both benefit. The minute I have to hide something from you, I'm being dishonest. It's not necessary. The incredible thing about a business transaction is that I don't have to tell you this is a used, I must tell you this is a used table. I don't have to conceal it, because you're perfectly happy to buy a used table. That's what it is. That's how it works. And it encourages this openness, and it encourages this communication, and it encourages a peace with one another. Because why fight with one another? Why shoot at one another? Why try and destroy one another when there can only be one winner, and sometimes there are two losers? Why not rather trade with one another in which there are two winners? It happens every time. A trade means both people win. Business encourages trust, it encourages mentoring, and it encourages caring for people. Successful business people, obsessively preoccupied with the needs of other people. That's right, they're trying to find out what people will buy. Now, you can be cynical about it and say, oh, they're just doing it for their own profit. Or, as I bring us in for a landing, you can choose to say, I don't care about their motivation. Of course they're doing it for themselves. You know, they're not Mother Teresa, but I'm the beneficiary. That's the nice thing about this. And so that's why I speak about restoring the dignity, respect for the dignity and morality of business. And that's why it is that it began to make perfect sense to me, finally, why people on the airplane said to me and say to one another, and why you probably do the same thing, hey, what do you do? It's not an invasion of privacy. It's not, hey, how do you make a living? How do you get your money? It's not that. The question is really, and what is it exactly that you do for other people? How do you help the world? That's what the question really is. What do you do to help others? And you answer it with pride and with happiness and with joy. So, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate the opportunity of being with you here this morning greatly. I'm going to give Andy, ask him to accept a very small gesture of my appreciation, which is a copy of my recent book. It's called Thou Shall Prosper. It's called The Ten Commandments for Making Money. And not surprisingly, commandment number one is feel good. See the moral value that comes out of making money. Because if you're not stealing and defrauding and robbing people, the only way you're making money is by making other people happy. If you see that, there is no obstacle holding you back. And you end up not only doing well, but also doing good. Pleasure being with you this morning. Thanks for having me.